sponsoring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
ICIJ, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, has done it again. A trove of records has been revealed on how politicians and official figures evaded taxes through offshore tax havens. Financial secrets of politicians, billionaires, and the global elite included the likes of the former UK Prime Minister, Tony Blair, in which it revealed that he avoided paying hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxes. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why this practice of avoiding taxes using offshore tax havens continues, and why authorities have failed to stop it.
It's being described as the Panama Papers of 2016 on steroids. The Pandora Papers, a leak of almost 12 million documents allegedly linking some of the world's richest and most powerful to huge secret assets, tax avoidance, and money laundering. It's the job of hundreds of journalists in more than 100 countries, spending months combing through files as part of the largest ever global financial investigation. Among their findings, secret financial dealings of the King of Jordan, President of Russia, the President of Kenya, and hundreds more politicians and celebrities, some of whom allegedly used shell companies to buy properties here in the UK.
Oxfam have calculated that the amount concerned comes to some $427 billion lost to national economies and tax around the world. Money could be spent on hospitals, schools, all the things that the masses of the people need, especially as we come out of this global pandemic and the economic crisis that has spawned.
One of the two British names so far in the revelations, former Prime Minister Tony Blair, who allegedly avoided paying hundreds of thousands in property tax on a townhouse while buying the company which owned it.
And this is a guy, Blair, who never tires of going around the world telling other people how they should live their lives. He's treated as an elder statesman in British politics. The media had never done having him on their show to give his views on all the issues of the day. A man who's got the blood of a million Iraqis and more in the region on his hand.
The other Briton named Mohamed Amirsi, a major Conservative Party donor who funded Boris Johnson's campaign to become Prime Minister, involved in one of Europe's biggest corruption scandals. The UK Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, has promised an investigation into the revelations. But when asked whether he was ashamed that London is a haven for those looking to get out of paying their fair share, he said he was not.
He himself is a former top executive with Goldman Sachs, so he's plugged into this kind of thing. He knows it goes on. I'm sure sotto voce, he would say that's part and parcel of the game.
Some are now questioning whether the UK is doing enough to regulate the use of shell companies and tax avoidance measures. Analysts say this makes it harder for citizens to trust their leaders.
For now, those allegations in the so-called Pandora Papers are, well, allegations. There's no proof that any of the individuals mentioned in this story broke any laws. But whether those laws will have to change is something that the public will have to debate and decide. Site Tourism, London.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling, joins us from Bristol. And we also have journalist and political analyst John Bostanich, who joins us from Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Yeah, I'd like to welcome you both. And let me first start with you, John Bosnich, and ask you if you can, for people who may not know what this is all about in terms of the revelations, what tax evasion is, what offshore tax havens are they legal, are they not, and what it is that these politicians, billionaires, and official figures have actually done.
Well, it's definitely a complicated web, and the purpose of these havens is to deceive the tax inspection authorities of the home countries of the politicians and persons involved. The real reason for these havens is not just to avoid taxes. If it were just an accounting matter about how much money the individual politicians and other powerful individuals owe to their state governments, that would be another matter. The real reason that this is such a scandal is that the purpose of the tax havens is to hide the existence of the money. And the reason that the existence of the money is being hidden is because much, if not all of the money, comes in the form of bribery. That's the issue at heart of this problem.
Okay, now you've opened another door here. So let me get back to you on the bribery thing and ask you, Tony Gosselin, if you can explain to us the depth of what this is so we can get an idea for those who may not have even heard of what has occurred. Because we're looking at pretty large figures, 330 politicians, high-level public officials in more than 90 countries. You could probably tell us better.
Well, you know what? I think it's interesting to see who is in this list, because you know, the likes of Rishi Sunak, he's saying, oh, well, we're going to have an investigation, the British Chancellor. But he's the sort of individual that could actually be using some of these techniques to hide his own wealth. And certainly that's the sort of thing he would have been coached to do at Goldman Sachs. So I'm a little bit cautious when I see a big leak like this. Blair, for example, is a major figure. But this is the sort of thing that everybody is doing. It's not, in a way, not news. If it was a criminal offence that he'd been committing, then it would be. But many, many wealthy and powerful people are doing this sort of thing all the time, de rigueur. And it is actually part of a sort of, almost a secret club of the super rich, the super wealthy, that get on and do this. And there's a lot of people, I think, that are not on this list that may well be up to these kind of techniques. So, for example, we're seeing a lot of political leaders, a lot of celebrities, names which, you know, many people will recognise. But what about those names that people wouldn't recognise? Big business leaders, you know, sorry, for example, from the pharmaceutical industry, the likes of Bill Gates, for example, using these sorts of techniques. And so I think what I'm trying to say here is that there's a tremendous amount of discretion at the Washington, D.C.-based ICIJ that's released all this as to who they dob in and which documents they release, or whoever's leaked it to them, and who they don't. So, yes, it's obviously something needs to be done about the massive amount of tax avoidance going on in offshore jurisdictions. And many of these, of course, are British overseas territories, for example. But then Switzerland is an enormous great one. It's very difficult to know how these sorts of places can actually be closed down as tax havens without international agreement. And this, of course, is another side to all of this is there going to be ever some sort of international agreement? There's a lot of push for it at the moment. In fact, Rishi Sunak himself has been saying this, that we've got to have some sort of agreement, and this is a further push. But I'm a little bit suspicious when I see that certain very powerful and important names, for example, people involved in the British royalty, do not appear to be on this list, and yet these are the sorts of techniques that what they would have been using regularly. Also, we've got to look at the funding for these sorts of big journalistic organisations. Now, you would have thought, for example, with hundreds of journalists working on a topic, that there are all sorts of, for example, dodgy deals in the arms trade that these journalists may have and should have found out. But no, they're handed all this information. And this organisation, the ICIJ, in a way, is a sort of competitor to WikiLeaks. Remember, Julian Assange now has done 10 years in jail. And I just did have a look to see what they had to say about Assange. And actually, there was an article by Yossi Melman, who is actually opposing Assange, saying, oh, Assange is terrible, blah, blah. So this is the sort of new way, post-WikiLeaks, that stuff is coming out. And it's very partial. So some people will be dished the dirt on, and other people will get off scot-free.
Okay, well, I have to ask you, John Bosnich, what you meant by bribery, and tell us if you can name names, and tell us overall what percentage of this money we're looking at is in the form of bribery.
Well, I don't think I'm opening any new doors of perception here. The fact of the matter is that a large number of the leading military and economic powers of this world today, of well-known, well-respected countries, are themselves the subject of an oligarchical power network inside their countries. And so these state leaders, these prime ministers and these presidents, are becoming more and more not the initiators of policy, but the presenters of policy. They are like a narrator of a film in which they themselves are not an actor. They play the part of head of state. They play the part of head of government. But in fact, they are being selected because they look good on camera. They are believable to the gullible population of the country, and they follow orders from their own domestic deep state, and be that America, England, France, or any other influential transnational entity. Because these countries do not operate only within their own borders, but they use their own state as a base for raiding and controlling other states. This is the bigger aspect of this issue. It is not just a question of crooked politicians avoiding taxes. If it were, it would not be nearly the story that it is. This is a story of crooked politicians who are selected to be politicians because they're crooked before they even start. They are then placed into power using multi-million dollar political campaigns, which are fine-tuned to deceive the public into picking one or more of the controlled political puppets. These puppets are then paid their bribes and their money under the table, which they then hide offshore. That is the entire scenario.
Tony Gosling, do you have a reaction? And if you do agree, who would be at the top of the list?
Well, the top of what list?
The top of the list of what description that John Bosnich gave in terms of a politician, let's say.
Well, look, politicians are actually fairly low down the food chain. Obviously, the celebrities, they sell newspapers, and so there's a legitimate interest in them, and of course in the politicians because they're known faces. But at the top of the list, I mean, I think in terms of who we need to be keeping an eye on, and I'm not entirely sure that that's what's been going on here, people looking at those, the most rich and most powerful who operate behind the scenes. We're talking really here about the pharmaceutical industry, big oil, also, of course, the fintech sector, that financial technology, and the finance sector, the City of London, at Wall Street, all these kinds of characters. And I think the journalists aren't doing themselves any favours by concentrating, and there may well be other leaks, that we've only just come across this massive dossier of people who are in these very rich and powerful positions. Those are the sorts of people who I would be much more interested to see them, because they like to stay in the shadows. And in fact, by concentrating on the sort of celebrity status of the people who are in these leaks, the journalists are almost playing their game. I mean, the Bureau of Investigative Journalists in London was run for a while by Ian Overton, and I remember having a conversation with him saying, well, look, when is the Bureau of Investigative Journalists going to look into the big questions there are around the 7/7 London bombings? And he told me, he said, well, actually, there's no need to do an investigation. We know exactly what happened. And this, I'm afraid, is the attitude amongst some of these organisations around the world that have got massive budgets and loads of journalists on their side, is they don't want to look into the really deep, dark crannies where where people like me, freelance journalists like myself, know that some of the most important facts lie. And so also we have to ask the question, where is these leaks from? Who has actually leaked them to these journalists? And I would suggest it's probably financial sector people, and also possibly intelligence services. Because if you look at the numbers of politicians, there's a definite bias towards the whole Western anti-Russian, anti-Eastern European attitude. That is to say, you know, various people around the world, including, by the way, this organisation, the ICIJ, did a whole leak very recently, I think it was maybe 2 years ago, looking at China through the prism of the Uyghurs, saying, oh, look, all these Uyghurs have given us all this information about how terrible the Chinese are. Well, this is just following, you know, the Western geopolitical agenda. Right. And I have a real tendency to look at these big leaks. Yes, there's some fascinating information in there, but really just part of a you know, anti-China, anti-Russian propaganda campaign.
Well, one of the things that we need to talk about here, John Bostich, is which the ICIJ mentioned, is how, and it called it the most troubling, one of the most troubling revelations, and it said is the U.S. and the role that South Dakota, Nevada, and other states had adopted in terms of financial secrecy, and how they're being used as actually, in a sense, tax havens, it said, rivaling those of offshore jurisdictions, and obviously revealing America's complicity in the matter. Tell us what your thoughts are on South Dakota, Nevada, and other states maybe that you can tell us in terms of the way it has served that purpose, which is offshore, an offshore economy, as it said.
Well, of course, these are euphemistically referred to as liberalized financial sectors in Nevada and other states in the United States. They use the word liberalized to suggest that there's some more form of freedom. Well, yes, there is more freedom, and that's the freedom to steal and to bribe and to coerce by financial means. The fact that there are these kinds of internal havens in the United States is merely a reflection of the fact that the United States is the physical and financial center of the Anglo-American Empire, which grew out of the colonial empire of England. So this is just an old way of doing business. It was illegal, and it was permanently illegal in England and in the United States as they built their empire. But the judges and the prosecutors and the lawyers were paid and given status in society to look the other way. These things have now been leaked. It is a certainty that there are financial authorities involved in getting access to the leaked information and filtering it out to the public in a manner that's understandable. But it is even more likely and more certain that it is the interference in domestic Western affairs, these are their words, by Russian, Chinese, and other intelligence services who have discovered a treasure trove of the criminal activities of the leading investment bankers, the leading politicians, the leading public thinkers, and the leading communicators of the Anglo-American Empire. And this is the crux of the matter. They not only choose to dominate the world anti-democratically and illegally by force of arms and by coercion, but after they dominate the world, they still don't even admit the amount of money that they take for themselves as just simple graft and bribery. And now that these data are being released, the entire lid is off of the matter, and the way things are done in the West and around the world should change. And journalists, and this is a comment that I join my fellow commentator in expressing today, is it's high time that journalists were journalists and not paid propagandists for the media owned by the oligarchies of the countries in which they live.
Well, I'm guessing, Tony Gosling, not guessing, but I'm thinking that this is a good thing that these types of revelations are being released.
Yes, of course, yeah.
And I want to come at you, Tony Gosling, if I may, through the span of what the ICIJ had in its report in terms of, for example, the offshore holdings. And it said offshore holdings of more than 130 billionaires from 45 countries Now, when you have 130 billionaires who are not paying their taxes, according to Forbes, 100 of the billionaires had a collective fortune of more than $600 billion. Now, we're looking at that while millions across the world are living in poverty, okay? Especially now when COVID has hit, you're looking at 150 million people to have fallen into poverty. These taxes that they're not paying could be going towards nation building. So that isn't that one way of looking at this?
Well, the trouble is at the moment, paying tax in many of the Western countries is simply something that goes on repayment of national debts. So it doesn't necessarily go to public services and spending here in the West anymore. After the 2008 bailouts and also succeeding bailouts, much of the revenue that is taken in tax simply goes in debt repayments. And so this is, I mean, I'm not saying it's not, we shouldn't be getting the tax off these people. Of course we should. And in fact, for almost all, well, all those billionaires will be able to take half of their wealth away from them. They wouldn't notice any difference whatsoever in their lifestyle. In fact, you could probably take 90% of their wealth away from them and they wouldn't notice any difference in their lifestyle whatsoever. So that's the sort of excess wealth they've got. And of course, you know, in any kind of just world, that wealth that should be... I mean, for example, we're in a situation now, aren't we, where some of the super wealthy are just playing games with shooting rockets to the moon for space tourism. You know, your Richard Bransons, the Musks, etc. And this is because they've got far too much wealth and they've been able to keep it to themselves. And it's just a little kind of toy they're playing with. Of course, that wealth needs to be taken. But there is a much bigger side to this, as you've said, between the maldistribution of wealth, the perverse concentration of wealth in the hands of a tiny number of people, and land, by the way, in the hands of a tiny number of people. And in order to do something about that, we have to do something about these tax, what they call secrecy jurisdictions, as John Christensen at the Tax Justice Network regularly talks about. He's just retiring, which is a shame to see. But, you know, this is what they've been concentrating on. And in the Anglo-Zionist Empire, there is a battle going on right now, and that is a battle between the financial elite, the financial oligarchy, who largely are anonymous behind the scenes, and the democratic and media institutions which guarantee us our freedom. Those are on the back foot and they're losing. And I see this as possibly anyway, another actual assault on our democratic institutions and, you know, some of our personalities that are behind media. I'm not absolutely sure about that, but also the timing is really interesting, very important here in the UK, where this has just happened at the cusp between last week's Labour conference and this week's Conservative conference. So all of the Labour donors will be being ignored, and all the Conservative donors, Conservative conference season, everyone's forgotten about the other side. So this is an assault on the Conservative, who are really the only people opposing internationalism at the moment here in Britain.
Okay. Last word to you, John Bosnich. So a couple of statements there made by Tony Galson said something should be done about it. Department of Justice in the U.S., other justice departments across the world looking at these troves and revelations, why don't they jump at this and go after the ones who are evading taxes illegally?
Well, we go back to the conspiratorial nature of this entire subject matter. Yes, we've got oligarchs who have enriched themselves personally. They then effectively purchase politicians to use them as pawns in the further expansion of their wealth. And the last element of all of this, and it's the element that we've seen over the past 20 years in particular, is that once they've bought up the wealth and assembled the wealth as the richest people in the world, and they've bought up their politicians and made them into personal assets, the last and most effective and destructive step is they buy up the media. The so-called lying mainstream media that President Trump used to refer to.
Okay. I'm sorry. Unfortunately, I got to jump in because we're just fresh out of time. I do apologize for that. Let me thank guest, historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosselin, spoke to us from Bristol. And you were just listening to John Bosnich. Thank you, journalist and political analyst from Belgrade. That does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitafoe and the entire team, it's goodbye.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoint.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light, and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint.
A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and my dear brothers as guest speakers, my guests here in the studio, Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah. Brother Hussein, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam, glad to be here.
And Sayyid Abdullah, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We are criticizing the movie An Interview with God, a 2018 drama film directed by Per Lang. Before we continue talking about the movie and criticizing this movie, let's take a listen to a part of the movie and I'll be back with questions.
Is there a heaven?
Oh, yes, but try not to think of it as just a place.
So Satan is also real?
Yes, but frankly, Satan is overrated.
Overrated? That's a funny way to put it. How so?
He only has power to the extent that you give it to him.
What happens to us after we die?
You are reunited with the everlasting.
So my soul is immortal?
Wouldn't be much of a soul if it wasn't.
You were listening to the part of the movie An Interview with God. In this program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. Brother Hussein, let me start with you in this episode. In this part, Paul asks God, is Satan real? Well, basically the answer is like, Satan is overrated. This is what the person claiming to be God answers. So Satan is overrated and has power to the extent that man gives it to him. He leaves it wide open, in fact, to the man's imagination and capacity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. That's a very good question. I found that a very good comment, you know. It's one of my favorite parts of the movie, actually. It's true. He is very overrated. Like, they always paint him as this, like, you know, big evil guy who, you know, all he does is just give you ideas. Bad ideas. Mm-hmm. But he gives you ideas. He whispers in your ear, right? And it's really your choice to take his advice or you know, take control of your own life. So... you know, it's like that thing we have in the sayings. It's like Shaitan has a rope for everyone who he's trying to pull, and then some people don't even need a rope. Some people come to the Shaitan without you know, they come to the devil without.
They follow him without the rope.
Yeah. So the quote from the movie really exemplifies this.
Yes, Sayyid Abdullah, do you find this answer given by God, in fact, in unison with, in harmony with Islamic teachings?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Not precisely. See, what he said to him, he's overrated and he has as much power as you give him, indicating that Satan, to some extent, he has a bit of power, but you can increase that power as you go on depending on your temptation. Yes. The fact is, Islam says Shaitan has no power. Islam, when it's not for the Quran, when he looks at Shaitan, he says, wakana shaitan da'ifa, along these lines. Like, the Shaitan was weak. He himself, as creation, is weak. The Shaitan, he himself, he talks in the Quran, he says, da'awtukum fa'ajabtumuni. All I did is I invited, and you came. So, in reality, what the Quran trying to project when he talks of the Shaitan, or when the makra shaitan, okay, the Shaitan, kana da'ifa, he only can send you an invitation. That's all he can do. Yes. So he has, it means what? He has no power. unlike the Christian theology that makes the shaitan like he can control you or he can force you to do things or he tempts you, even temptation itself.
And we have so many movies about exorcism, by the way.
Exactly. That's a field of his own. But they do project. So when he says he has as much power as you give him, indicating that he can take over you, he can control you. But the reality is the Quran looks at it or the Sunnah looks at it as he has absolutely no power whatsoever. And the guy, he himself in the Quran says, "Da'awtukum fa ajibtumuni." And then he says, the Quran is very cunning. Even in the Quran, it gives us what he will say on the Day of Judgment. He says, "Fala talumuni," do not blame me. Blame yourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yes. So which indicates what? He has absolutely no power. He's as weak as
it could. But so much for his weakness. Don't you agree? Mm-hmm. Like you say that according to the Holy Quran, he says that, well, he's so weak, right? He's created this way. But even against this fact that he's so weak, he can tempt so many people. And most of the people, in fact, follow Shaitan.
No, see, I think this is a fallacy.
Except the righteous.
No, I think this is a fallacy. Shaitan, he, like I said, the Quran says, he himself says, "I have nothing." You guys. See, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when he created the soul, he says, in the way Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala puts it, he said, "Fujur alhamaha, fujuraha wa taqwaha."
Yes.
The yin and the yang. Allah created in the man, right?
Exactly.
Fujur wa taqwa. And what controls this fujur and taqwa, this righteousness and evilness, is your soul. Is your nafs, right? Your nafs is in control. Now, what does your nafs move towards? If you're a person, for example, who wants to pleasure himself with the stuff, say you would move to fujuraha, right? You would move to this side. The shaitan, he says, you know what? Since he goes that way, let's come and just, you know, beautify the road for him. And then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran says, فَزَيَّنَ لَهُمْ أَعْمَالَهُمْ. He beautified their actions to them.
Mm-hmm.
So he comes and he just helps along the way.
Yes.
He doesn't actually forces you. You make the choices.
Exactly.
You choose. Because like I said,
as Brother Hussein said, he whispers in our ears.
Yeah, so he whispers, he invites us, all he does.
He tempts.
But even like he can tempt anyone, but then you have the free power, the free will to reject. Doesn't matter. This is his job. He will attempt even the prophets, as we have in many narrations. He goes to the prophets and try to attempt them.
Okay.
But that's his job.
Yes.
But would it work or not? No, that's up to you. You choose. So even whether you're a prophet or whether you're a common person or just a normal person, the choice to commit an action is absolutely yours. It got nothing to do with the shaitan.
Yes.
Because on the Day of Judgment, I could simply say to Allah, "Shaitan made me do it."
Yes, okay.
That will not work.
Okay, so stay with us. We're going to be back after a short break.
Is God love?
It doesn't boast, but yes, absolutely.
What's 2,427 times 648?
1,572,696.
For real? I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. God forgives.
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. Brother Hussein, we are talking about or criticizing the movie An Interview with God. In this part, Paul asks God, "Is God love?" And God's answer is, "Yes, absolutely."
Yeah.
Well, and after that, a couple of minutes, like, or moments after that, the journalist, Paul, tries to check some facts. By asking God about numbers, like when he asks him about the multiplication, and then he later finds out that the multiplication was true.
The answer was correct.
The answer was correct. Yes, and then God says, "God forgives."
God forgives. There
are these general concepts that we have across all religions and denominations, that God is love, and God is forgiving.
Yeah, I guess that is true.
Is God love, really?
I'm not sure about that. I really never really understood that phrase. But in terms of that whole multiplication thing and then God forgives, I mean, the love thing comes in later. So
yes.
It reminds me of that story of Prophet Ibrahim when he was kind of like doubting Allah.
Mm-hmm.
And then he asks Allah, "Can you just show me like one thing, like piece of proof that allows me to, you know, لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي," he says, so that my heart can be at rest.
Yes.
So he goes and he cuts all those birds up, as I recall. So, anyways, at the end of the day, as I recall, the ayah said something like Ghafurun Rahima, Allah Ghafurun Rahima, or so it kind of relates back to this. So he was kind of doubting this God, you know, quote unquote, and he wanted to test his math skills with you know, a kind of a complicated formula. So when he did, and then he checked that he that the product was right, okay, then he said God forgives, right? Because, you know, he's saying, you know what, it's okay to doubt, but at the end of the day, because I love you, I forgive you.
I see. Sayyid Abdullah, why this theme repetitive in many, I'm not talking about cultures, but religions, divine attributes, like God is loving, God is forgiving, God is like this and that, you know, so many divine attributes.
Yeah.
And that gets repeated throughout all religions.
Yeah.
All right? Why is it so?
It's simple. If I give you a phone right now, just a, as we call a brick, right? You would look at it and you would say, okay, it's just a phone. But if I say to you, it's a Samsung, automatically something just pops into mind, right? I tell you, it's got like a, you know, a 50 megapixel camera. You know, you're expanding your amount of information. What expands? I tell you, it's got like a, you know, top of the range processor. I don't know, it's got like 32 memory. It's got like, I don't know, 2 gigabyte of RAM. The more information I give you, what happens to you is that you have a clearer picture of the device in front of you, and you get attached to it. Through what? The description that I gave you. With Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is exactly the same. In order for me to know Allah, for me and you to know Allah, is we need to know him through what? His attributes.
Yes.
So you tell me Allah is, his name is Allah. I'm like, okay, Allah has a just generic name. It holds no sifat. You tell me Allah is Ar-Rahman. And Ar-Rahman is the one who encompasses his mercy to everybody. Right. Ar-Rahim to those who is special. Ar-Ra'uf at this, at this. Once you finish the 100 names, or if you can go to Joshua and Kabir, you have 1,000 names. And you get to have a clearer picture of who are you talking to, who you are communicating to. So this sifat, that whether it's in Islam or Christianity or any other religion, is just to give you a clearer picture, to shape for you who Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala really is.
But the kind of picture painted by different religions sometimes gets different. Like, I was talking to an expert in theology, that was his field of study, and he was telling me a very good, like, valid point. And he was like painting the picture of Judaism as like of God, of course. He said that God is a little bit harsh in there.
He is extremely harsh.
But when it comes to Jesus Christ, he's Christianity, he becomes very loving.
Yeah.
All right. And then when it comes to Islam, it's a bit of both.
Exactly. So Islam levels the field.
Yes.
Because if you read the Old
Testament, it's like
Testament,
both Jamal and what do you call it, Jalali aspect of God.
Ahsan.
Both of them.
Excellent. This is exactly what happens to in Islam. Islam always is like, even Allah says, "Ja'alnakum ummatan wasata." We made you a nation that is in the middle. So Judaism is very barbaric in its nature. If you read the Old Testament,
exactly. I've read
the
it.
New Testament is extremely soft. Right. Whatever you do, God is love. God will forgive you. You know what? You know, you
just believe in me, trust me, hope.
No, not just that. Like, you could go to a confession box and say, God, forgive me for
our sins. Jesus died for their sins.
That's it.
Right?
And, you know, you get it. Like, you say whatever. Like, I killed somebody in the red box, and you come out and you sin free.
Yes.
That's, you know, so this goes extreme length to compare to Judaism. Where in Islam, Allah says, no, I am Rahman, I am Rahim.
Yes.
At the same time, Shadidul Iqab.
Yeah.
You know, my punishment. I do punish.
Yes,
so
exactly.
When you take this sifat and you apply them to yourself, you stay in balance.
Yes.
Yourself.
You stay in a state of like hope and rejah too.
Hope and fear. So like, hope I don't want to do this because God will punish me, and I would want to do this because God will reward me. So it keeps you in balance.
Exactly. And it's reflected throughout the Holy Quran too, like la'allakum, meaning that there is no guarantee that you're going to be forgiven.
Exactly. So,
so you have to be all on the edge of the seat.
Always on your toes.
Yeah, on
always
the toes,
up to you.
Okay. Thank you very much for your nice contribution and answers, both you, Sayyid Abdullah, and Brother Hussein. This is the end of the program, Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Javad, the host of this program. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You're saying...
Yes.
This interview, it's eating me up.
It's really an interview?
Yeah.
With God.
You're telling me to pray. Cat hurt?
I'd like to talk to you about salvation, Paul.
So you're here to save me.
Do you need saving?
Doesn't everyone? We try to be good people, try to please you, and we need some answers. And where did you go? You have any idea how that feels?
Sometimes there aren't signs when someone's in trouble.
Paul, I've given you a great gift. But it's up to you to receive my gift before it's too late. Your life is not an audition for the afterlife.
I don't even know why I agreed to this. Who are you?
You know who I am.
Interview with God. I love it.
You're kidding.
About time God made the front page. You disagree.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
From the yellow vests to the longest general strike the country has ever seen, France under President Emmanuel Macron has been the site of constant grassroots expression, but also shocking political repression. For the first time since the coronavirus epidemic began, France's unions called a nationwide strike, with protests taking place in over 200 cities and towns. Unions and workers are accusing politicians and bosses of manipulating the corona crisis in order to ram through more far-right economic austerity measures. Deeply unpopular cuts to unemployment insurance take effect this week, despite the ongoing economic uncertainty.
The government has used a pretext of health concerns, cut wages, to cut government jobs, to reduce worker rights, and to allow bad working conditions to get even worse. It's great to see everyone from workers to students to pensioners back in the streets again, because these cuts to unemployment are unacceptable during these tough times.
A decade of failed austerity, followed by the unprecedented corona recession, has given France's lower and middle classes a list of problems too long to fully mention. inflation, energy prices, intense corona-related restrictions on personal freedom, unemployment, soaring inequality. But perhaps most telling is that even conservative politicians now talk of the need to, quote, make work pay, because French wages and salaries have been so stagnant for so long.
La vie a augmenté à tous les niveaux.
The cost of living does nothing but increase, and in seemingly every possible way. Costs are even higher than when the Yellow Vests first began, but we haven't been allowed to demonstrate. Until salaries are increased, things will continue to be more and more difficult for the French.
Protesters say that the coronavirus lockdowns and work cutbacks are too often presented as some sort of welcome and generously subsidized vacation. The reality is they have been catastrophic for many average households. The French street is alive with protest for the first time in over 1.5 years, and it may decide the outcome of Macron's re-election bid this April. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
We had become well used to hearing Donald Trump being slated in the European Parliament during debates, but perhaps didn't expect that his successor, Joe Biden, would also attract scathing criticism.
He did not consult us when he withdrew from Afghanistan. He completely sidelined us in the AUKUS deal.
AUKUS relates to a new military pact between Canberra, London and Washington. It means a deal involving France building submarines for Australia has been scrapped. This has created big tensions between the EU and the US. The reaction from European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen to the tensions has not gone down well.
We have a Commission President who recently proclaimed her empire, stating European military forces would be part of the solution. When will the EU recognize it is part of the problem, not the solution?
Some legislators say the EU can no longer talk about values while at the same time cowering to America.
This is a country which is ruthlessly pursuing an espionage case against Julian Assange for publishing information about US war crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq, including attempts to kidnap and kill him.
Many members of the European Parliament claim the Donald Trump era proves that EU leaders will never stand up to the United States.
For example, what did they do when Trump tried to start trade wars, took the US out of the Paris Climate Agreement, withdrew funding for Palestinian refugees and supported Israel's illegal occupation program? And what about his rubbishing of the World Health Organization amid a global pandemic?
Lawmakers say revelations that the US continues to spy on top EU politicians, officials and institutions has also eroded trust. Experts agree.
It is absolutely central to explore ways in which trust could be re-established across the Atlantic. Trust not only between governments but also private sector and individuals who are very much concerned about, you know, how their data and their information is used.
Members of the European Parliament, MEPs, say Biden's failure to rejoin the Iran nuclear deal, despite indicating he would, also illustrates how the United States cannot be trusted. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The hunger strike of 6 Palestinian prisoners who have refused to eat for days have once again brought the plight of Palestinian prisoners to attention. The 6 are on hunger strike to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention, demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them.
Israeli prison authorities refused to deal with the hunger strikers' legal demands. Kaid Al-Fosfos has been on a hunger strike for over 82 days. Mehdad Al-Gawasmi for over 76 days, and both were transferred to Goblan Hospital. Ala Al-Araj as well has been transferred to Al-Ramlis Clinic. Their health condition is deteriorating, but they insist to continue with their move to end their illegal detention.
In solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners, Palestinians, including prisoners' families and relatives, have protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah. Here, every week, you'll see prisoners' mothers and wives holding the pictures of their beloved ones. They say they are the voice of the prisoners.
My son Mujahid went on a hunger strike and ended it after the Israeli authorities decided not to renew his administrative detention and to release him. Mujahid spent almost 10 years in jail and then he was rearrested after 15 months of release. His administrative detention has been renewed 3 times. That's why he started the open-ended hunger strike. I know he was risking his life, but that was only for the hope that he could be released to live with us, his family, and to raise his only child.
Administrative detention is illegal, however. It's a tactic that allows Israeli authorities to put Palestinians behind bars indefinitely without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers. Today, Israel holds 4,600 Palestinian prisoners in its jails, with 520 of them under the illegal administrative detention.
Despite repeated warnings about the hunger strikers' deteriorating health conditions, Israel has always been defiant in dealing with their legal demands to make sure that no more prisoner follows the same path in the future. Unfortunately, Israel ends the administrative detention only when hunger striking prisoners are on the verge of death. Mona Kandil, Occupy Jomullah.
Tensions between China and Taiwan have once again escalated after Taipei reported that 148 Chinese fighter jets flied over the island's air defense zone since Friday. That was a day Beijing marked the founding of the People's Republic of China with a military parade. Taiwanese government officials said they have to be on alert for China's, quote, military activities, while Taiwan's president Tsai Ing-wen said the island would do what it took to defend itself. This is China regards a self-ruled island, a breakaway province waiting to be reunited with the mainland. It maintains sovereignty over the region under the One China policy. However, Taiwan says it's an independent country and seeks help from the West, especially the United States, to boost its defense. Currently, the U.S. is Taiwan's largest weapons supplier, despite having no formal ties with the island. On Monday, China once again lashed out at the U.S. for selling arms to Taiwan and sending its warship to the Taiwan Strait. The foreign ministry described Washington's actions as provocative and irresponsible and urged it to stop bolstering Taiwanese separatist forces. Some experts believe the U.S. is hatching plot to further push Taiwan into secession from China.
The U.S. is trying to push the envelope as far as possible, trying all kinds of tactics and measures to push Taiwan forward as if it was a separate country without declaring its former status as a separate country.
The South China Sea is yet another bone of contention, with the U.S. routinely sending its warships, citing its right to freedom of navigation. The U.S. has no claim over the strategic waters, but it misses no chance to play with the sentiment of other countries having maritime stake over there. The U.K., a major U.S. ally, is also not far behind. Last week, London sent a warship through the Taiwan Strait for the first time since 2008. That despite China's constant warning to the U.S. and its allies over such moves. For years, the U.S. and China have been at loggerheads over issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong and Taiwan, to the South China Sea. But ties between Beijing and Washington deteriorated sharply under former President Donald Trump. China had hoped for an improved relation under Trump's successor, but since taking office, Joe Biden has maintained pressure on China, showing no sign of discontinuing on his predecessor's hardline policies. Biden is even seeking new alliances to counter China's rising influence in the region and beyond.
This is a crisis that was said to have blown over. It was supposed to be a gradual return to full fuel tanks and drivers reassured that the very worst was behind them. Those in England's southeast continue to be hit especially hard, and despite army personnel now helping with the distribution of fuel to forecourts most in need, Business Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng denied the UK was at crisis point.
The last few days have been difficult. We've seen large queues, but I think the situation is stabilizing. We're getting petrol into the forecourts.
For consumers, the minister's words may well ring hollow.
I just think it's embarrassing that, again, we live in the UK, that we have to get the army to drive trucks. So, yeah, ridiculous. I think it's what we just get used to now, isn't it? I mean, that's just how it is. This government's terrible. Preceding governments have been just as bad. I mean, it's unbelievable. Yeah, this shouldn't be happening in the UK today.
You should bring in foreign help. I mean, workers from abroad who actually know how to drive lorries and to carry the fuel to the pumping stations.
UK is a very big country and very rich country and a developed country. All this mess should not be like in your life since day one. So I really don't understand all this mess, really.
It should have been business as usual at these pumps, but for many drivers, they'll be wondering whether or not their reality is being matched by the rhetoric coming out of Downing Street, and worse still, if this is a shape of things to come. The government's had to admit that one of the solutions touted to alleviate the crisis, relaxing the visa rules for experienced EU HGV drivers, has underperformed.
What we said to the road haulage industry was, fine, give us the names of the drivers that you want to bring in and we'll sort out the visas. We've got another 5,000 visas. They only produced 127 names.
The worry is that this fuel issue becomes a crisis of confidence in Britain's ability to deliver the basics for its citizens. This might leave more of a damaging legacy than the government cares to admit. Amina Taylor, London.
As the humanitarian crisis looms in Afghanistan, Yaron's new shipment of humanitarian aid to Afghan people containing tons of foodstuffs has arrived in Kabul. This round of Iranian aid was handed over by Iranian Red Crescent Society in cooperation with its Afghan partner.
The Iranian Red Crescent Society, in cooperation with the Red Crescent Society of Afghanistan, has sent the first consignment, which is including the 15 metric tons of the humanitarian consignment, mainly the food items, including the rice, canned beans, and as well as the macaronis and other sugar and other food items, which is necessary for the people in Afghanistan.
These aids are provided amid the rising hunger as a result of political crisis and the blockade of Afghans' assets by the U.S. Afghans and aid groups believe that the country wouldn't face the ongoing crisis if the U.S. had not frozen its assets.
We thank Iran and other countries who are helping Afghans these days. Our main concern is U.S. sanctions that are pushing people to unprecedented hunger and poverty. The U.S. and other countries must consider humanitarian needs and separate it from political issues. Many countries want to send money to the people of Afghanistan, but can't do that due to sanctions.
Our situation is really dire. I have lost my job and I don't receive my salary anymore. I urge international countries to help poor Afghan people who have nothing to eat these days. Some are displaced and live on the streets.
2 decades of war have left Afghanistan impoverished. The U.S.-led war in the country came to an end in August when all foreign forces left Afghanistan. Afghanistan is faced with a multitude of crises. Health clinics are closing down, while rampant inflation is treating people who have been left with little money and food. All that's against the backdrop of Afghanistan's frozen assets abroad. In such circumstances, assistance from the international community, especially the neighboring countries, will be a welcome relief for millions of Afghans. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
With the second shipment of Iranian fuel already making its way to most Lebanese areas, the electricity crisis has somewhat been lifted. Private generators and companies have welcomed the initiative by Hezbollah to bring in Iranian fuel through Syria.